Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
What is going on, everybody? Welcome back. Another episode of D&Ms with Dean. On this episode of the podcast, I sit down with the founder and CEO of Sober Brewing Co., Clinton Schiltz. Now, he's not only the CEO and founder of that, but he's also a psychologist that's worked in Aboriginal communities. And this all kind of stems back from his own upbringing as an Aboriginal man and seeing the struggles that people had to go through, the struggles he had to go through, and then wanting to help, wanting to make a difference and wanting to kind of use his struggle, his pain, his knowledge to help others. And he's gone from that, and then he's moved away from drugs, alcohol, and seen the benefit that that made on his life and his family. So he's done that, and now in doing that, he kind of realized that there wasn't many non-alcoholic options that you could find. So he's like, well, I'll make my own and I'll push that. So the very first non-alcoholic craft beer in Australia and one of the best tasting ones I've ever had. So definitely a fun podcast to do. It was fun to kind of pick his brain where he wants to go with it and kind of how sky's the limit and how he's trying to build a community of people around him. He also talks about the amount of racism and hardship and struggle which comes with being obviously an Aboriginal person, and then also with starting up a non-alcoholic brewery in a country that is very dominated by alcohol as the theme and is used as, I guess, a masking agent to hide from a lot of things that we should see. So very interesting conversation with Clinton, and I really hope you guys enjoy it. Before we get into it though, quick word from the sponsors. If you guys want to mix up your morning routine, you know what to do. AG1 is there to help. Great tasting, good for your immune system, good for your health, and just good all around for you. So if you guys want to get some of that, I'll put a link in the description. You can jump on that, get some free travel packs, get some free vitamin D, get yourself feeling right, especially going in winter. You want to look after yourself. It's getting colder. People are getting sick. You don't want to get sick. You want to be running at 100%, and AG1 is the one to do that for you. So follow the link, try out some stuff, see how it goes. Now, here's the podcast with Clinton. I was going to ask you, before we get into the brewery side of things, because when I saw on your name, it's Dr.
Yeah.
Clinton Schiltz.
Yeah.
Where does the doctor come into play here?
Yeah, so I'm a psychologist by profession. So I've got a PhD in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health. I specialise in social emotional well-being. Aboriginal myself, so I'm Gamilaroi man myself. So my mob will come from Northwest New South Wales, but I've been here on Kumbumeri country, here on the Gold Coast for sort of the majority of my life, and my dad's side of the family have been here for generations, so I've got really close connections with mob here. I was a chef originally, so everything's sort of come kind of full circle over the last, I'm 40, 45 this year, Yeah, things have come full circle. So I left school when I was 15 years old and did a chef's apprenticeship and looked after my baby sister at that same time as well. And chefed for 15 years or something. Had the opportunity to chef all over the Gold Coast here, trained in some really good restaurants, then worked up all through the islands, Great Barrier Reef, and then went over and worked overseas in the UK and different parts for a couple of years, and was doing some surf contests and stuff over there as well, just to have a bit of fun with. And while I was over there, I decided I wanted to come back and do something a little bit more meaningful with my life, and I started writing up some programs to sort of help kids that had, I guess, come from similar backgrounds as me. And I'd seen when I went through school that unless you, if you're an Aboriginal kid, unless you played football or you're a great athlete, you got fuck all support. And I don't think things have changed too much now either in that space, but it really used to piss me off because, you know, we've got kids out there that were great at art, music, academia, whatever it was, but they just wouldn't get the same levels of encouragement or support from the school system. So I started writing up a heap of programs to come back and kind of be able to work with kids like that in community, and I started hitting up some big organizations, and they were like, yeah, these programs look really good, what's your qualification? And I'd go, I'm a chef, and they'd basically just turn to me and go, well, what the fuck has that got to do with these programs you've brought us? And I'd go, well, nothing really, but like, I was one of these kids and I've managed to travel the world and had a lot of life experiences, and I think I've got something of value to give back. And yeah, they pretty much all just said, well, come back to us when you've got a piece of paper and something saying you're qualified to do what you say you want to do. So I rocked into Griffith University and went into the Aboriginal Student Support Centre there, and I just said, look, this is what I want to do. And I showed them some of the stuff that I'd been sort of mapping out and planning, and I said, what do I need to study? And they literally just wrote out a whole bunch of different degrees on a piece of paper and said, you could probably do any of these. And no fucking word of a lie, I shut my eyes and I just sort of spun my hand and went smack down on a piece of paper and said, I'll do that. So I literally fell into psychology and kind of landed in between psychology and exercise science. So I went, well, fuck it, I'll do a double degree in both of those. So that was my process about what I was going to do at uni, and did that for a couple of years, and then got sort of midway through the exercise science part of the double degree, and when we had to start working with like the cadavers, the dead bodies and stuff, and they fucking stink, and from all my years of chefing, I've got a really sensitive nose, and they just smelt like off bags of prawns to me, and I just couldn't get my head around it. So I had to fucking drop exercise science. So then I just fully concentrated on psych. So yeah, did that. Got through my undergrad, went in, did my honours, did pretty well in that. Went out and worked in the field for a few years as a psych to get my registration, and then decided I wouldn't mind going back to uni and doing a PhD. So I was working at the uni already. I was a lecturer at the uni in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health, and thought, well, if I'm here, I may as well fucking do the PhD as well. And I kind of didn't really want to do it, but then we had some unfortunate losses in community. We lost a close friend who was an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health worker, and unfortunately passed to suicide, and had a few people come to me and say, well, fuck, Clinton, you're in a position to, you know, do some research around why this keeps happening to our workers out in the field, and to hopefully make some change. And so, yeah, that kind of put a bit of a rocket under my ass to go, yeah, well, yeah, I'm privileged enough to be in a position where I can undertake a PhD, so, and look at some of these issues. And when their marnies tell you you've got to do it, you don't really get to say no. So that was it. So I did the PhD, and that's how I ended up with the doctor in front of my name.
Mm. Why do you think the biggest reason that these people were taking their lives in those situations?
Yeah, it's, I mean, there's a multitude of reasons related directly to the work that we do, but you know, it's colonization at the end of the day is the big, is the number one factor that impacts on any of our well-being, black, white or brindle, to be honest. I think we're all so messed up by this colonial system that we've been entrenched in and programmed to work within that, and it's really unhealthy. Like, it's an unhealthy system that we're told we should want to buy into and work into. But then when you come from, you know, groups of peoples like us as Aboriginal peoples that are far more collective in nature and far more likely to be concerned about other things outside of themselves, I think a lot of the stresses just continue to snowball and add up. And on top of that, there's a whole bunch of issues around lateral violence. And I guess for anybody who hasn't heard of lateral violence, it's kind of violence that occurs between in-group members through experiences of oppression. Like, when groups are feeling really, really oppressed and they just don't know what to do with all that frustration and anger, they tend to take it out on each other. And so, unfortunately, we get a lot of lateral violence in our communities because we see limited opportunities, we live with constant oppression, and, yeah, people don't know what to do with that.
I guess a good example of that was when COVID happened and people turned on each other pretty quick.
Yeah, absolutely. It is that experience. People were feeling oppressed through not so much the disease, but through the control, the legislations that were being enforced upon them and controlling their lives to a point where sometimes you feel the only decision you do have to make or not is to, do I enter into conflict or not, or do I, you know. So, yeah, I think it was a period of time where many Australians had not had the experience of what we've had to feel every single day for the last 230 odd years, you know, everything in our lives being absolutely controlled by an outside body that thinks it knows what's in our best interest, but generally doesn't bother talking to us.
Yeah. You see it when you watch like the movie Rabbit Proof Fence, and you see the whole thing behind it is they look at it as they're doing you a favour. And that's the big message they push. It's like they want to be what we are or want to be converted into our Christian way of living.
Yeah, I think, you know, as human beings, we've got this tendency to try and excuse ourselves from responsibility a lot of the time. So we'll often come up with excuses to explain our behaviours or circumstances that we've caused, because no one likes to sit there and actually have to compute the damage that they've, you know, that they have or that they potentially are causing to other people. So it's very easy for me to turn around and go, well, it wasn't me, I was just doing my job, for instance. But, you know, my law as a Gamilaroi Gomeroi man doesn't function that way. Like, you learn from a young age that you are wholly and solely responsible for what you say, think and do. So there's no room for blame and escapism in that. And I think it's an unfortunate thing that for many of our mob, they haven't had the opportunity to really delve into and learn the true nature of our ways of knowing and being. And I think it's just as great a sadness to me that we don't have the opportunity to really teach other Australians how to live in that way that is just driven by obligation and responsibility, because we'd have far less societal problems in this country if we were living in ways that were more attuned to First Nations ways of knowing, being and doing.
Even like with elders and stuff, you look at how we live our life normally, and as a society it's like, all right, you get to a certain age, nursing home, out of mind, out of sight,
yeah,
see you later.
Yep.
And you look at, obviously, in Aboriginal culture and a lot of other cultures, it's like that's where you get your knowledge from. That's where you get your information from.
It's also where your responsibility, your obligation lies. Like, if, you know, if someone had to wipe my ass when I was an infant, why should I think that I'm too good to have to return the favour as they enter old age? Someone had to feed me. Someone had to house me. until I was in adulthood. Why should I think that I shouldn't have to return that obligation to my parents who put that in, that effort, that expense in their lives into affording me the opportunity to do the things and to have the experiences that I've had. So it is, it's extremely weird for me, things like childcare system that we have, aged care systems that we have, they're just about channeling people into this corporate commercial capitalist system at the expense of connection.
Mm.
And then we wonder why, you know, kids are all running amok and have limited respect for their parents and particularly for elders at times. Well, they haven't actually been taught that stuff. They haven't had the opportunity to really deeply build notions of connection with those that are closest to them, because fuck, we put kids in daycare centers at a year old, and then institutions are managing their lives and teaching them what they want them to know all the way through.
Mm. That's one thing I've noticed now. Every time I see kind of like adolescent boys, it's more rare to see someone that's actually being a decent person. You see them in groups, and I just keep seeing these like boys just do dumb shit and like breaking stuff, and you see them like throwing line bikes off cliffs and just like really disrespectful. And you're like, I don't know, for me now seeing that, like I was not really like that. I feel like I grew up in a pretty good family and had people that you could look up to and learn from. But a lot of those boys or kids just don't really have that. They don't have a proper guidance or mentor to show them like, no, like understand what a dollar's worth and understand what property's worth and understand how to live. And we just, like you say, we get more and more pulled away from that.
And they're actually not raised understanding responsibility.
Mm.
They're raised in a world where escaping responsibility is actually a paramount part of the system. Like we live in a litigative based society where everybody is trying to escape responsibility. No one wants to take ownership. So, you know, we forget that kids absorb and they learn everything that they see all day, every day. So when they just see a bunch of adults constantly trying to escape their responsibilities, well, of course they're not going to learn that they need to develop a sense of ownership of their responsibilities. But then we blame the kids, and then they rebel against that rejection.
Mm.
They're products of what they've had the opportunity to learn and know, and then we further reject them for acting in the ways that we've actually taught them.
I was going to say, you said before when we were sitting outside that you would be happy to sleep in a tent because you grew up with nothing. How was your childhood and how did that kind of shape you to be who you are and to get you to where you were or where you are now?
Yeah, you know, like I came from very, very humble beginnings. You know, my mum and dad split up when I was very young. They're both very young parents. My mum was only 17 when she had me. My dad was only 20 at the time. Things didn't work out for them. You know, my brother was my I've got a whole bunch of siblings, but my oldest little brother is
oldest little brother, yeah.
Yeah. Literally, I've got to say this sometimes because like there's a 21 year gap between me and my youngest little brother. So my oldest little brother is only 3.5 years younger than me. So it's a very different situation for me and him as it is for, you know, between me and some of my other siblings.
Mm.
But, you know, we, by the time we were sort of 6 and 3, we were living with a single young mum who was only 20 years old herself. And hadn't had the opportunity to finish high school or you know, further her own position. And, you know, she ended up in a relationship with my stepdad who, you know, it was a toxic relationship and there was constant abuse around. So I guess for me and my brother, we grew up as kids in a position of just out of fear a lot of the time, which I've managed throughout my life to process in very different ways to some of my other family members have. I've been able to take some of the positives out of that. I've been able to forgive the people involved, because there's just no point holding on to that stuff. It doesn't do doesn't do anybody any good at the end of the day. But yeah, I guess, you know, I had to grow up really young. Like I was doing, literally, I was doing all the cooking, cleaning and the shopping, grocery shopping in my house by the time I was fucking 10 years old, raising my little brother. And then by the time when I was 15, I was working full time, I was studying and I was looking after my baby sister so that my mum could actually have the opportunity to go to university. Because I didn't want my fucking sister going off to some daycare centre and being turned into a little shit by the system, basically. So I had to grow up and I had to learn responsibility really young. When I was 18, my 15-year-old brother, I was living down here on the Gold Coast by then. I was doing my apprenticeship down here, living in a flat by myself down here. He turned up one school holidays and said, "I'm coming down for the school holidays." I said, "Yeah, no worries." And he fucking just never left. So I was 18 with my 15-year-old brother and we're living in a beachfront apartment in Nobby's Beach, having to fend for ourselves at the end of the day. So, yeah, I think, you know, those things have put me in a position where I've had to learn to take responsibility for certain things. I'd never say I'm a fucking angel. Like, I've made every freaking mistake known to mankind and I was a shit of a, you know, a adolescent and young adult.
Were you somewhat rebellious because of the situation?
100%. Not so much because of the situation, more because I didn't want to deal with my trauma.
Yeah.
So I just stayed drunk and off my face, like, all the time. That way I didn't have to...
Hiding from it, yeah.
Didn't have to deal with it. And I didn't know that's what I was doing at the time. 100% it was. As long as I was fucked up, I felt good. Well, I thought I felt good. And that'd just lead me to doing dumb shit quite often. But it took me a long time to get to a point where I was ready to actually stop, turn around and face some of that traumatic history.
Was there a pivotal moment when you realized, okay, I gotta hit this thing head first?
Yeah, really when I had kids. Like, until I had kids, I didn't, you know, I didn't have other people. By that time, my siblings had kind of grown up a bit. They were able to look after themselves. So I was in this period of my life where I was kind of had freedom for the first time, you know. Like, I didn't have to be looking out for anybody else. I could just be an idiot. And I probably took that too far on many occasions. So... It wasn't
kind of be careful what you wish for, hey, because you want the freedom, then you get the freedom, and then what you do with it isn't possibly the best thing either.
Yeah, I mean, for me, probably the most difficult part of my journey was because I'm so highly functioning, nobody really knew how bad of state I was in. So I didn't have people checking if I was okay because people just thought I was fine and I was the life of the party. People didn't know that I was pretty messed up and at multiple times in my life, suicidal. That was probably the most difficult part. And I can't blame anybody for that because I didn't probably express myself in a way that led people to feel that there was anything to worry about.
Yeah, it's easy to hide behind a smile.
It's easy to hide behind cocaine, man.
Yeah.
To be honest. And that's what I did for a long time. I just stayed drunk or I was just off my face. And yeah, it's easy to hide trauma behind that stuff, but you can't do it forever. Either physically or mentally, you'll be spent at some stage. But fortunately for me, you know, I met Lozen, my wife, at uni when I was, you know, we were both at uni at the same time and I was 28, I think. I was younger than that. No, I was 28, I think. I don't know, somewhere. 26, 28, yeah, somewhere around there. Actually, I must have been... Yeah, I was 28. We've been together 17 years, so... I was 28. And we fell pregnant pretty quickly, and I'm just extremely fortunate that she's been such a caring and stable sort of rock through that healing part of my journey. Like... Why the hell is she bothered staying with me in for many of those years. I don't know, probably because I knocked her up and she didn't think she probably had many other choices. But
sure, there's more than that. But
she was probably like, man, being a single mum can't be would have to be worse than dealing with this dickhead.
Well, how was like, because obviously the trauma of seeing the, like your childhood and seeing the, like the role of your stepdad, how that played in the domestic altercations and whatever went down, that would obviously flow into your relationships and in your life.
Look, I've never really been an abuser of other people. I've just been a self-abuser. Mm. Like, you know, people often say, and in psychology it's definitely, you know, a practiced position, that abused people abuse people. And that's definitely been my observations. But I would add to that, that abused people don't always just abuse other people. Quite often abused people turn that abuse on themselves. Mm. So I was very self-destructive and self-abusive.
I heard this thing and my mate was talking about it the other day, and he's just like, heroes and villains both have the same backstory. Both comes from pain.
Definitely.
It's just like, okay, I've been hurt. I'm going to hurt the world. Okay, I've been hurt. I don't want anyone else to feel this. I'm going to save people from the world.
Yeah, and I was a villain towards myself, and at times that probably crept out on others. I probably ended up in way too many stupid punch-ups in pubs over next to nothing when I was drunk, because I'd be triggered. But I wasn't aware of what were triggers for me because I hadn't bothered to sit down and process any of it. So I was very reactional in my responses, but never towards partners, never towards my family, just myself or randoms. And I always throughout my life was like, if I ever have kids, I do not want them to grow up having the same experiences as me. And I've, you know, and so as soon as I had kids, you know, my oldest boy's 16 next month, and as soon as, you know, he came about, I was like, well, I really want to be mindful that I don't treat him the way that I was treated. And I couldn't sit here and honestly say that at times I haven't lost my shit. Like, I've fucking verbally lost my shit multiple times. I've never physically fucking harmed my kids. But yeah, I've probably been triggered by shit, again, by not even knowing it, and just gone off my fucking head over probably trivial shit, to be honest. So I've had to continuously work, and I still continuously work on trying to be mindful of what's my shit and not projecting that onto particularly my family, but also others.
Mm. Yeah, I understand there's a reason for everything that kind of comes out, and I'm sure there'd probably be stuff that he does that you could probably see in yourself when you're a kid. And that would almost be triggering in a way, because you're like, don't do that. Don't do it down that path. Don't do kind of something that I may have done or was doing.
Yeah, it's different. You know, like, all my kids are pain in the asses in different way. And all parents, if they're honest with themselves, would say that. Like, my 16-year-old, he's, you know, he's probably the most polite, respectful kid going about. But he's, when it comes to I guess, pulling his weight or completing tasks to their absolute, you know, there's some issues in those spaces. So,
But you're also seeing this coming from a person that was raising his brother when he was 10.
Yeah.
So it's like, you've got a level of,
that's it. You know, like, I don't know if he can make fucking Vegemite toast, where I was literally having to cook breakfast, lunch and dinner every day, as I said, from when I was about 10 years old. So it is a very different, it's been a different existence for him. But then my 14-year-old, everybody tells me he's exactly like me, and he frustrates the shit out of me.
Because he's you.
And I'm like, man, that can't be true, because if I was that annoying, like, somebody would have killed me.
I was going to say, it's funny how that it's like, nah, he's you. I'm like, oh, that's probably why it pisses me off so much.
Yeah, and I see a lot of elements in him that are very much like me. So he's so into, particularly over the last 12 months, he's so into physical fitness. He's the life of the party. He's really ridiculously intelligent. He's one of them annoying kids that, again, like me, does no work at school and gets straight A's. Never seen him do any homework. Never seen him study. His report cards always say he's got straight A's and he's a wonderful child at school. And I'm like, well, fuck, he's not like that at home. And my mum always goes, yeah, your report cards were always the same.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's very much like me. And you know, we clash over certain things. Love him to death, but we clash over certain things. And then my six-year-old, you know, he's grown up in a completely different household to my older two. Like, I've been sober for 10 years. He's never seen me drink. So he's never seen alcohol, you know, pretty much even in our house, like, because we don't have alcohol in our house. So it's such a different thing for him. Whereas I became sober because my oldest boy, when he was six, came in on Christmas morning and put it on me and just said, Dad, can you stop drinking silly drink? And that was when I really just went, yeah, you've got me, mate. And I just didn't touch alcohol after that.
How did that feel when he said that?
Yeah, it was beyond grounding. It was flattening, you know, like I'd been out on an absolute bender the night before and I thought it was hilarious to come home and they'd been watching, like, I think it's A Nightmare Before Christmas or some zombie type freaking Christmas kids show, and I thought I was hilarious walking around the house pretending to be a zombie, and I scared the fuck out of them. And they couldn't sleep that night, so they had the shits because they thought Santa wasn't going to come because
there's a zombie in the house.
There's a zombie in the house, and, yeah. And Santa doesn't come if you're not asleep, apparently. So, yeah, he just came in and put it on me, and that was the moment that I just went, yeah, no, you deserve better, and you're only going to learn something different about society if I actually created in this house, because unfortunately it's not outside this house. Like, alcohol's such a entrenched part of our society that the only opportunity that our kids get to learn that there is other choices in terms of being able to socialise, in terms of being able to enjoy yourself, in terms of being able to deal with your frustrations, your stresses, etc., is if we take it upon ourselves to teach them that. Because they're not going to get it outside our doors. So I just, in that exact moment, made a decision that that's it. I want them to learn something different. I want them to see that they can, mostly, that they can deal with, work through adversity throughout their lives without fucking turning to alcohol.
Mm. How do you see that as well, obviously working as a psychologist and then with Aboriginal communities with alcohol, the impact that had?
Nothing probably shits me more in the world than hypocrites. And I was the fucking biggest hypocrite in the world for many years while I was working, in my younger years working as a psychologist. I was working a lot in drug and alcohol rehab and then going out and getting plastered and off my fucking plate, off my face. So I had a lot of lived experience, so I knew what I was fucking talking about. And I think that's why I had a really good connection with all my clients.
Yeah, you got it, but...
But yeah, I was fucking doing everything that I was telling them not to do at the end of the day. And so I was never actually satisfied with myself in the work that I was doing because I knew I was being a hypocrite. And so it was actually really freeing for me in terms of my psych work that I do when I made that decision to fucking go sober, because I was like, wow, now I can go home at the end of the day and know that I'm not basically talking shit, that I'm working with people using my lived experience and my professional knowledge in a way that is hopefully beneficial for them on their own healing journeys, and I'm not going and fucking destroying myself afterwards.
Mm. How was the pushback though from friends, family, everyone when you kind of did go sober? Because I know just from personal experience, you don't have a drink and you're out and yeah, you just cop shit.
Man, I lost 70% of my friends, I reckon, overnight. Which hurt, you know, like a couple of them I had to basically say, look, if you don't want to support what's in my best interest or the best interest of my fucking family, then you're not my mate and you can fuck off. I'll make room in my life for those that do want that. So that was difficult. And I think that's one of the biggest barriers to, for many people who want to make, you know, better life choices. Maybe it's drinking, maybe, it, you know, quitting drinking, or maybe it's something else. But I think at times we get so caught up in other people's opinions, and also so caught up in trying to hold on to dead relationships rather than allowing ourselves to just make the decisions and put in place the changes that we know are in ours, our best interests, in service of those that we're connected to.
Mm. Yeah, it's okay to let go of these people.
Yeah, absolutely. And you soon find out, as you start doing that, that there's plenty more people out there in the world to make friends with. And you'll find a whole bunch of people who do share similar values and do want to see you be able to grow in your life and do want to see better outcomes for you and your family. And that's really rewarding. And I think when you hold on to some of those leeches at times, you're not allowing space for those new people to come in.
Well, it's just time and energy. You only have so much of it in a day. And if people are taking it, no matter how that is, whether it's good or bad, it's still going to take something out of you. And if you're in those situations where it almost shines a spotlight on their own, it's like when you start achieving and people get really annoyed at you or want to put a ceiling on it because it's a direct representation of where they're at or if they're not doing something they need to do. And then they get resentful towards you when it's like, you've done nothing besides go after what you want. But then they're like, and you see it a lot in small towns. It's like, you want more. I'm like, oh, why do you want more? You're too good for this, kind of thing. Or you don't want to drink. Oh, you're too good for drink. And they project their own insecurities straight onto you. And that's so common, especially when someone's drinking and you're not. And I think they feel like they're going to see a side of them. And you're going to see it with clear eyes. And I think that makes them feel uncomfortable as well.
It definitely makes people feel uncomfortable. You know, it definitely makes people question their own decisions and they don't want to have to do that. I get so frustrated still today that, you know, if I end up going to a wedding of friends, or if I happen to go to an event where a lot of my old friends are at, and everybody, like, we're in our fucking 40s and people are still standing around talking about our war stories from freaking our 20s and acting in the exact same way. And I just, you know, at times it makes me feel sad that people haven't allowed themselves to grow. But everybody's on their own journey, and I don't judge anybody for where they're at. I just have to decide if that's not the type of scene or people I want to be around, then it's up to me to not do that. I can't expect everybody else to be where I'm at, and that's okay. Some people may throughout their lives want to make changes in their lives, and I'll be there to support people if they want assistance in that moving forward, but at the same time I can't force people to want to do better for themselves.
I think you have the control to walk away. Like, you always have that control. It's like, this is not for me anymore. What you're doing is nothing wrong with what you're doing.
Yeah.
But I'm going to remove myself because this isn't serving me for what I want to do. And that's okay. And not feeling guilty for that either.
That's it, you know. Like, I wouldn't have been able to achieve anything I've achieved in the last 10 years if I'd still been on the piss. I wouldn't have had the time. The greatest asset I got back in my life when I stopped drinking, and people always ask me, you know, what was the biggest change? What's the biggest benefit? And for me, 100%, it's time. Like, I'm not wasting time drinking, and I'm not wasting time being hungover. So the hours that I managed to get back in my life have led to so much more productivity. It's ridiculous. You know, I still work full-time outside of working at Sober full-time, as well as run consultancy on the side of that, and still have time to go to sport with my kids every afternoon and to train fucking 10 times a week myself. Like, there is no way any of that would be happening if I was still wasting time. And my way of wasting time for a long time was drinking. So I'm extremely grateful for all that time that I've got back in my life, because it's allowed me to achieve things in my life, particularly at my age physically, that I definitely wouldn't be able to do. You know, I never would have made it onto Australian Ninja Warrior in my 40s if I was still on the piss.
How'd you go in that?
Oh man. It was a fucking nightmare. It took me 5 years. So it literally started with, I was good mates with Deadly Ninja, Jack Wilson, and he came to my middle boy's 8th birthday. He's 14 now. Came to his 8th birthday, and I'd custom made this massive Ninja Warrior rig. And so we had this Ninja Warrior party and everything, and the first season had just been on, and I was stupid enough to say in front of my kids, "That looks easy." And they both my older boys turned to me and said, "Well, go on then." And I was like, "Fuck." And I'd made a commitment, and I stick to the commitments that I make. So I said to them, "I can do that." So I was like, "Well, I'm going to do it." So it then took me 5 years to actually get onto the show, and made it to interview nearly every year, and then something could happen. I'm so prone to injury. I'm the most injury freaking riddled human on the planet.
Perfect show to go on.
It's my own fault, because I refuse to warm up, warm down, stretch. Like I'm like, that's time I could be actually training.
Yeah.
So I'm my own worst enemy when it comes to that, but I always end up injured. And so I'd always end up injured between auditions and the show. And then eventually I get on, and we're down in Sydney, and I was out in the warm-up. I had a bit of a niggling injury, but it was okay. I could still hammer through it. It was all right. I've had shoulder injuries for a long time. Like, people in their 40s aren't supposed to be swinging off shit and doing laches, you know, long-ass laches across stuff and putting that much pressure on their shoulders. I swear it's not. So I already had a bit of a niggling injury. We end up down in Sydney. We down there to film the show, and my boys, my niece, my nephew, they'd all come. I'd had an entire Aboriginal riders club, motorbike club, all turn up to support as well. And I'm out the back just playing around on the warm-up rig. After we had to do a physical before it, and I could feel the niggle. I was like, "Yeah, it'll be all right." Got through the physical without showing any signs of injury, and then straight before we're due to start all going out, I'm playing around on the warm up rig, and I tore my bicep tendon, and I was like, "Fuck!" I was in that much pain. Like,
you're trying to hide it as well.
Tried to hide it. And they could see that that something had happened. And they were just like, "We don't think you can go out." The producers are like, the medic was like, "He's not going out." And the producers were more like, "We just did so much background production on this guy." Like,
he's going out.
He's going out. And I was like, and they're like, "Well, what do you want to do?" And I said, "Look, my whole family's here. I've got a whole bunch of mob out here who've come to support me, but I'm going." But I literally couldn't even lift my arm up. Like, it was a bad tear. It was a great, ended up being grade three bicep tear straight off the shoulder.
Yeah.
Like, it was fucked. And so I basically had to just run across the first obstacle and then do this big, like, leap as if I was trying to grab the
second
obstacle. And yeah, I just had to, like,
oh no.
And fall in the water. But nobody knew that I was injured, because like, you're out in production and everybody's up in the stands. So none of my family had seen me for 8 hours.
Mm.
And so they just thought I'd just succumbed to pressure or stress or fucking something and just fucked up. Rather than I'd had to go through this orchestrated thing of
just jumping straight in the water. Oh no, not again.
But also, like, have to sign all these freaking confidentiality and agreements and stuff. So you're not allowed to talk about anything on the show until it's produced and on air.
Yeah.
So I wasn't actually allowed to tell anybody that what had happened and stuff until the show had been on. And the show wasn't on for 9 months after we filmed it.
Oh,
so for 9 months, all these people that were there just thought I was just useless.
Just thought he sucked.
In the water, including my 14-year-old who'd put me up to this in the first place. He's like, I think the first thing he said was, I can't believe I sat here for 8 hours for this.
Just to watch you jump in the water.
Fuck. No empathy whatsoever.
No, savage.
So, you know, but that, for me, the whole thing, like my commitment to him was always, I'll get on that show.
Mm.
And I'd got on the show. So my head probably wasn't in the game anyway, and it probably led to me getting injured.
Mm.
Probably should have better prepped. I should have at least strapped my freaking shoulder. But I think I'd already let go. I think I'd already gone, I achieved what I came here to do, rather than I'm here and I could probably fucking make it to the final of this thing.
Yeah.
It's
a funny thing when you set a goal like that to just get on, and then I had... did an interview with a girl and she was going to the Worlds she was an acrobat and the goal was just to get there.
Yep.
And she got there and then she almost let off the gas when she got there because she'd achieved the goal of getting there. And she thought back afterwards like, oh, how could we have gone if we actually were like, we could win? And it's like you take your mind off that, like you stop setting those goals and you kind of reach it and you go, oh, this is kind of nice.
And I reflect back on it and it's something that I've actually done multiple times, particularly with sport in my life. Like ever since I was a kid, like I was always a really good medium and long distance runner. And I'd always go to regionals, always go to zones, regionals, end up at states. And every time, like I reflect back and I think every time I remember going, I just want to make states. And I'd always kook it at states. So I think I'd just always set this pattern in my mind of, oh, you made it here, you can shut off. I did the same thing with speed skating when I was a kid. Like I was training to try and go to the Olympics for that when I was a kid in both inline and ice. And same thing. I just want to get to states. I just want to get to nationals. Mm. And then it'd switch off. And so I think it was just this unconscious setting that I'd had for it throughout my life.
I feel like you kind of made it. Yeah, it's like in coast now.
It just came up in that moment.
Mm.
Again. But I did that because I wanted to, like my whole purpose of going on and committing to going on to that show and putting myself through that torture for freaking 5 years. I shouldn't say torture because I actually do love it and I'll probably make a mate if the show ends
make
up
a
back,
return.
If the show ends up back on TV, I'll be back on. Like it's there's no two ways about it. It's fun at the end of the day, but it hurts. But my 14-year-old, my middle boy Bowen, he's had a history of like sort of giving up as well. Like physically, he is so set to be able to smash any sport he chose to do. You know, he's got the biggest fucking glutes you've ever seen. Can barely fit his ass in his shorts. Like he's built for sport, but he never pushes himself to actually fulfill any sort of level. Participation, he's just been, oh yeah, I'm just here and blah, blah, blah. And then he doesn't commit to things. And so I was like, well, maybe I can teach him that commitment can lead to you actually achieving what you set out to if I do it with this damn Ninja Warrior thing. But it, yeah.
Yeah, you just live it. Don't instead, say it, live it.
Instead, he just see me fall in a pool.
It is funny that balancing act of you want to push your kids through hardship to make them who they should be, but you also don't want to push them so hard that they resent you and hate you for what you've done. And
yeah,
that's definitely a fine balancing act.
It's a really fine balancing act, and it's something I absolutely sucked at. Both my older boys, when they were younger, they were right into BMX. They both raced BMX from when they were freaking 4 years old. They both went to national champs multiple times, particularly my older boy. They had the best coaches. They had the best fucking equipment. Because I never had that when I was a kid. Like, I was super athletic, but I fucking was the most pov kid in the school. Like, so I never had the good equipment. I always had the hand-me-down equipment or the cheap-ass equipment. So I had to actually work twice as hard in any of the sports I was doing to be at the same level. Didn't have nutritious food for, like, a whole bunch of things. So I tried to give them everything that they could possibly need to excel, but I probably became obsessive in that. Like, and I was also the worst soccer mum in the world. And so I was constantly trying to coach them rather than just be their dad and be proud of them for putting in any effort and being out doing something rather than being on a computer game, to be honest. And unfortunately, you know, it led to them both dropping out of that sport, and particularly my older boy. Like, he was actually really good, but he fucking hates it now. He won't go anywhere near a track. And yeah, I did that.
I see that all the time. So often parents try to push their kids into something and they end up pushing them out.
Yeah.
And again, it comes from a place of love and support, but the whole thing is like, does he want to do that? And does he want to do that when dad suddenly become coach? And it's like, if I don't do well, do I get, I've talked about this with a sports psych actually, about how it's like, do I get dad's love and support or do I get coach's disappointment? And that's, for a kid, that's a fine line.
Yeah.
To work. And I was like with my racing, my dad, I remember him always saying, it's like, I don't care what you do as long as you do something.
Yep.
I want you to put energy and passion and commitment into something. He's like, I could be washing the dishes. I could be playing tennis. That could be whatever it may be. Just do something.
Yep.
I don't want you to be lazy. I don't want you to sit in your ass. And I took racing on board, but he was never like, you have to. I knew if I quit at any moment, they wouldn't care. Yeah. And it was just such a, oh, I want to do this. I don't have to do this.
Yep.
And as soon as you get that feeling of I have to do something, of course you're going to rebel.
Yeah.
It's like, don't touch the hot stove. Okay, Dad. It's like,
I don't have to worry about that at my house because I don't think they know how to turn it on. So,
oh, it's funny. I was going to go back because we kind of, I really liked what you said there about with the not drinking. It gave you the time that you needed to obviously compete and do the Ninja Warrior thing. But that's a big part of it. It's like the time it saves you, and it's like, okay, drinking might not be that bad for you, but then it's like, okay, you start drinking. Okay, maybe you want to do drugs now. Maybe you want to go out later. You're going to lose sleep. You're going to, like, there's all these things that it's like a gateway to a heap of different things that aren't probably going to serve you. You might be around the wrong people. You might get in a fight. It's like all these add-ons. It's like the drinking might not be your problem, but it's like what comes from the drinking is then what turns into a bit of a nightmare for you. So it's like if you can just remove that item and then still go have a fun night. And it's funny as well, when you go out, you can kind of feed off other people's energy of how they're feeling. And almost if they think you're drinking, like if you've got like a, I don't know, like a soda with a lime in it, like, yeah, I've got a drink. And they think, you see the, how they interact with you is different. And you kind of almost feed off that energy as well. And like, they will almost make you feel somewhat drunk because they're kind of, that you kind of mirror that same energy back to them. But
yeah, like some of the best nights I've had out in the last 5 years have dead set been with my, one of my old uncles. And, you know, he's in his 60s. He doesn't drink either. And we'll stay out partying and dance until 5 in the morning. Like, we are the life of the party if we're out. But we both have become, you know, we've both learnt to be comfortable to do that. The hardest part of, I think, the hardest part of socializing for many people who are choosing not to drink, I think over time becomes putting up with drunk people.
Yeah.
Like, that's probably I struggle to be around drunk people. I don't like being drooled on. I don't like people fucking spitting on me when they're trying to speak. I don't like people tripping over me. I don't like people just talking random, pointless shit.
Just talk at you.
So you're not getting the best value out of anybody when they're drinking anyway. And so I find it really difficult these days to enjoy myself going out into situations where I know there's going to be lots of drunk people unless I'm with other people who are sober, because then I can just hang out with them and we can have a good time. But if I'm just out by myself as the solo sober person and everybody else is pissed, I still struggle with it. Because I just find it ugly, to be honest. Yeah.
Was that a big selling point for like making the whole sober thing, was to create that environment where people could always feel like they're drinking and like other people would almost feel like they're drinking around them as well, kind of make it more comfortable for everyone?
Yeah, the sober journey's kind of been an interesting thing, you know. Like, when I stopped drinking 10 years ago, there was no fucking options. There was Cooper's Birrell, which tastes like dog's balls. Like, it's fucking horrible. So that was people's experience of non-alc. So I can understand why people still are struggling to trust non-alc, because many people's first experience was pretty ordinary. So, you know, I got so frustrated when I stopped drinking. If I'd go to the bar, or if I'd go watch the footy somewhere, or if I'd go to a restaurant and say, have you got anything non-alc? And they'd say, oh, we've got soda and lime, like you just said. And then they'd sting me $6 for it. And I'd be like, I've got a fucking soda stream at home. I know how much that shit costs. Like, this is ridiculous. I'm not paying $6 for a glass of bubbly water and a wedge of lime. And your only other choice is soft drink, and I don't like soft drink. So I was getting more and more frustrated with not being able to enjoy sophisticated adult tasting beverages just because I didn't want alcohol. And so I thought, fuck it, I'm going to make my own non-alc beer, because I actually really love the flavor of beer. I love the bitterness. I love it as an old chef. I actually love what you can do with beer. Like, it's a great base to be able to build different flavors on, and I appreciate that part of craft beer industry. But there was no craft non-alc beers. And so I thought, fuck it, I'll start making it myself. And, you know, fortunate for me, I'd grown up with my granddad brewing from when I was about 6 years old. So I knew what had to happen. And I'm also, you know, I'm an academic. I didn't get a PhD by being a dumbass. So I knew how to do the research. So I'd done the research and I knew the process. And so I thought, yeah, I'm going to start making some non-alc beers for myself. And at that time, me and Lowe's had a food truck called Clino's Cut Murray. We were doing all Aboriginal style foods out of this food truck, and we'd got that because we were trying to help an Aboriginal NGO here on the Gold Coast, Preston Campbell Foundation, with their catering. We'd been bootlegging all the catering they were doing out of my kitchen at home, and I was like, fuck boys, we're going to get done for doing this at some stage. We need to do something semi more legit. So I thought, fuck it, I'll buy us a food truck, then we've got a legitimate space that we can do some corporate catering out of. But then it was sitting around a lot of the time. I was like, oh, we may as well use this, Lowe's. Let's turn this business in Clino's Cut Murray and do Aboriginal food. And tourists will love it and blah, blah, blah. And then I was making this non-alc beer and I was like, well, I don't need a license to sell this. So maybe I can just sell this non-alc beer I'm making out of a kegerator in the food truck and see what happens. And so we started doing that. And since we were doing Aboriginal inspired foods, we thought, let's infuse some of the beers that we're making with native ingredients as well and pair up the foods with the beers. And after a while, we actually had more people coming to the food truck to get beer than what we did food. And that's when we went, well, maybe there's something in this. And so we decided to sell the food truck and put our energy and attention into growing sober. And yeah, as I said, we were Australia's first non-alcoholic craft beer company. So there was a lot of resistance, both from the public, but also the profession when we started. Like, I remember going to a craft beer conference and I'd been invited to go down there and speak about what we were doing. And I got up and I started yarning about, yeah, we're making non-alc craft beers. And I literally got laughed at by all these people in the profession who I fucking know now are making non-alc craft beers. And hypocrites, mate. Yeah, love them.
Do you think that was the biggest challenge to start off with, was just the kickback of like, why are you doing this and there's no point and it's going to look stupid? And
it was more, I see things as drivers rather than challenges. You know, like, I've been pretty driven by people's low expectations of me since I was at high school. Like, I literally, when I was 15, I had the deputy principal of our high school said to me, I don't know why we bother. By the time you're 18, you're going to be dead or in jail. And that drove me to get a PhD. That that same fucking thing going around my head drove me to building a $10 million plus business. Like, I just don't like people expecting that I can't achieve because of where I where I've come from.
It's funny that those things sit with you, hey? Oh. They sit in the back of your brain and they be used as motivators.
And it's something at some stage in my life I'm going to have to let go of. Because I
Hold on. I know what you're saying.
I think at times it can become toxic.
Yeah.
Because it can drive you, it can drive your ambition in unhealthy ways, I think, just as much as it can in a healthy direction. I don't want to ever allow it to lead me to become obsessive about something at the expense of the things that are really important to me in my life, which is first and foremost my family, and then secondly my law and my culture, you know, like so I'm always trying to play with that of, yes, I want to always have that little, that fucking old cranky bitch in my head driving me forward, but at the same time I don't want it to,
I want it to control you,
to control me and take me away from what actually matters in life.
You can kind of keep you resentful in a way.
That doesn't make me resentful. It makes me, it motivates me to improve in all facets of my life at all times. You know, and that's a healthy part of it.
Yeah.
Holding on to the resentment part of it, I think, would be unhealthy. Trying to please somebody who's already fucking dead is not going to do me any benefit moving forward.
Yeah. I do know what you mean, though. It's the holding on, like, pain is such a motivator and such a fuel that you can use, but at what point do you go, okay, this fuel's kind of burning me now, it's not just helping me.
Yeah, and I think it's a trap that many people fall into, I think. Probably a majority of humans fall into is, all we really want at a basic level as human beings is acceptance. And when we start having experiences of rejection, we start seeking experiences of acceptance. And that can be really positive, but it can also very easily become toxic. So a lot of the youth crime we have, for instance, is driven by kids who have experienced rejection and then all start to gather together because they accept each other. And then they start doing dumb shit because they don't even know it, but it's releasing a whole bunch of endorphins and adrenaline and a whole bunch of other shit, which is what they go and continue to chase. They don't know that's why they're doing it. They think they're just hanging out with their friends and getting acceptance. But really, they start chasing those fucking good feelings that come from stuff that they haven't had before. So I think that side of rejection can really lead people in the wrong direction. If you're not mindful, if you don't have people to support you and guide you in a positive direction, because we just want to be accepted. So, you know, when I was being rejected by that deputy principal as a young kid, all I wanted was acceptance. So I went out of my way to try and do these things, thinking that it was going to bring some level of acceptance from somebody who, obviously, you know, nowhere to lie. By the time I got my PhD, I was on a deathbed. Like,
it doesn't matter.
It's kind of pointless.
It doesn't matter, yeah.
So at some stage, yeah, as I said, you've got to let go of that stuff and go.
I had an interview with a guy and he got all this fuel. His mum treated him really badly as a kid. Stepdad treated him really badly and she passed away when he was quite young, and he's still holding on to that pain. And he's like, oh, but I'm using it for fuel. And I'm like, bro, you can't hold on to it forever.
Yeah, I've flipped the fuel that, you know, like I copped a lot of abuse from my stepdad. And me and my brother have probably dealt with that in different ways, you know. Like, I dealt with it for a long way by abusing drugs and alcohol, and then eventually when I was able to process all that stuff, you know, like, I've dealt with it through love and acceptance. Like, when he ended up homeless for a period of time, I was the first person to call him and say, mate, you're welcome at my house. Like, I offered him a bed, offered him, you know, you can come stay here. Like, at least you've got somewhere safe. That was actually really freeing for me to be able to do. same as, you know, at a fucking massive level, you know, like as Aboriginal peoples, we hold on to so much resentment to the things that have been done to us and continue to be done to us. Like colonization is not something that's done and dusted. It's something we live with every single fucking day. But and this is completely honest and something I've probably never spoke about or told anybody, is one of the most absolute freeing moments in my life so far was last year when my wife, my kids, we all went over to the UK for one of Lozen's cousin's weddings, and we went to, I think it's St. Paul's Cathedral, the big fucking massive cathedral there in Rome, or just outside Rome. And you know, there's supposedly one of the apostles, you know, remains in the building, etc., etc. And I actually went down there, and I just had this quiet conversation, and I just was like, you know what, I forgive you and this religion for everything that it's done and continues to do to my mob. And I walked out of there crying, but it was positive. Like, it just felt really freeing to be able to just go, you know what? I can hold on to this hate and this resentment, which is going to do nothing but cause me fucking cancer probably. Or I can just go, you know what? I'm not going to forget about it, but I can forgive.
Mm.
And I can move forward.
And you do it for you. And your people.
Yeah, did it for me. But yeah, everything that I try and do these days is for those that I'm connected to and that are most important to me.
I think that's a big thing that people don't understand, is like a lot of the time you forgive someone for yourself, not for them.
Yeah.
And I think I know friends like, I'm not forgiving her because she's wrong and this and that. I was like, you're putting yourself through this pain, not them.
They're not even thinking about it.
Yeah. I repeat this all the time, but it's like hating someone, having resentment for someone is like drinking poison and hoping they die. And it's just like, you, like say you carry it with you, it turns into cancer, it turns into an illness, it turns into mentally just draining yourself constantly.
It does, and you know, unfortunately people aren't even aware how much holding on to negative energy, negative tension, stress actually impacts you physiologically. Like, and then particularly when you start adding on top all the negative coping strategies that people use to try and mask that stuff, like drinking again, it's a prime example. Like, Australia has such a bad drinking culture because most of the people who came here with trauma and were using fucking alcohol as their coping strategy to not deal with the generations upon generations of torturous abuse that they'd done to each other and then brought it here and continued to use that as a masking agent while they put that abuse on other people. And then we've just intergenerationally continued to do that without even ever stopping to think of, why do I drink literally this bottle of poison? Drinking the bottle of poison because it's a fucking negative coping strategy that makes you not have to think about whatever it is that you're uncomfortable with in your life.
Mm.
And some of that probably doesn't even come from you fucking sitting here right now. Like, we are a makeup genetically of everything that has come before us. We hold that at a genetical level. You know, epigenetics has been able to show how much trauma is carried across generations. But most of society is completely unaware of it. Like, most people, as I said, they come here, they don't even understand the histories of their families and therefore what they might epigenetically be carrying. And so they just fucking drink to not feel it.
Just hide it. Don't look at it.
Yeah.
Put it away.
And put it onto somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah, project it onto someone else. Yeah.
If I'm going to be stuck in my negative coping strategy and I don't want to have to reflect on that, well, the best way for me not to have to reflect on it is if I drag you into it as well.
And this has all happened in, like, how old is Australia? 200 something years old? 220?
230 odd years.
Yeah. like two and a bit generations. It's all so new, so fresh.
But, you know, as I said, like that, most of that trauma goes back hundreds, if not thousands of years of human to human abuse, violence and abuse. And humans constantly across history trying to find masking agents to escape the negative feelings they have from that abuse.
Yeah, it's like you need to, it's like this dominoes effect that keeps happening and you kind of need to stand up and put us like, kind of stops here and understand why as well.
And the only way it stops is if we literally take it upon ourselves to make a conscious decision to stop it with us. Otherwise, you pass it on.
Well, that's the thing. It's like when you ask someone, like, why are you drinking? And it kind of almost like stumps them and they go, oh, I don't know, because everyone else is. And you kind of break it down. You're like, do you actually know why you're doing this? And it's one of those things. It's like when something's so culturally accepted to be the outsider in any situation, you feel like an outcast and you don't feel good. So I was like, all right, well, I want to blend in. I want to fit in. And it comes back to everyone wants to try and fit in more in this society. And then by doing that, you lose track of, okay, who am I? What do I want? Where do I want to go?
Yeah.
And all that gets pushed to the side and you go, I just want to fit in.
That's it. Comes back to that notion of acceptance. People just doing what they think they have to do to chase that experience of acceptance from other human beings. Rather than, you know, allowing ourselves to identify the multitude of other ways that we can earn acceptance from others.
Is that something you're trying to do at Sober as well? Because I see you obviously have like the music and the art and everything. It's just trying to build more of a community of people around just what you're interested in and like with art and music and everything, just to bring a community of people into that.
Yeah. You know, when we first opened Sober, our big audacious sort of plan was to give people an opportunity to experience and embrace First Nations ways of knowing, being and doing in a contemporary way. The more Sober is evolving, the more we're realizing that, you know, if we're completely honest, we live in one of the world's most racist countries. And we have a limited amount of supporters, which means we're capping our opportunities for growth by being out there as this, you know, really overtly loud Aboriginal company. And that fucking hurts to know that, but it's a fact. We know that, you know, we had put ourselves into such a niche by one, being non-alcoholic, and then two, being an Aboriginal, very blatantly and loudly and proudly labelled Aboriginal brand, that gave us a very, very, very small market share. So we've had to make the hard decision to sort of pare some of that back and re-look at, well, what is it that we really want to achieve at the end of the day? And at the end of the day, what Sober was all set up as a social enterprise for was to enable us to raise independent funding and also awareness to causes that we know are working to help people in their social emotional well-being healing journeys at a grassroots level. Now, I'll have more opportunity to do that by screaming less about being an Aboriginal company, so that I have the opportunity to sell to more people. And then I can take that money and I can do whatever the fuck I want with it to help people. So that's kind of where we're at now, which, as I said, it sucks to know that. And post-referendum, it's fucking blatant.
Is it somewhat motivating as well at the same time? It's almost like you're vice principal again.
It's motivating, but at the same time, it's still fresh and raw. Like, there's so many of us who are still trying to process what happened last year, and many people with far less opportunity for positive coping than me, who are not doing great because of how much that hurt, how much energy got burnt up, just simply being the focus of the whole of Australia's attention for a 12-month period, and then to get what for the majority of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people was a very negative outcome and a massive form. Unfortunately, you know, how many people have processed it is as a massive a form of societal rejection. A big slap in the face of, we really don't care what you think is in the best interest of your kids. We'll continue to tell you what we think is in the best interest of your kids. And yeah, that fucking hurts.
Mm. Yeah, where you go from there, hey? That's what you say.
Yeah, you know, I was so involved with that whole process, and I've continued to be involved now in trying to help people process and work through the pain. And I'm trying to constantly encourage people that, you know, what we learned some positives through it as well. We learned that, you know, we actually do have a shit ton of allies out there. Not enough, but we still had a shit ton more than what we probably thought we had. Mm. And we can build on that. We can continue momentum on that. But I think the more important thing we learned, and we've probably had the opportunity to learn multiple times across history, is we can't fucking rely on governments to fix this for us. Mm. And that our best way to move forward as mob is to work with those allies that we do have, and to continue to grow that army, and continue to work in ways that demonstrate the positivity rather than the expected negativity, or the perceived negativity of First Nations culture, ways of knowing, being and doing, and law.
Mm.
Like,
just bringing awareness to it.
Yeah, bringing awareness to it, but also trying to, with the own opportunities that we have, with the own opportunities and resources that we have in our everyday lives, looking at how do I educate, infiltrate, and bring about change in a positive way that is influenced through those positive principles of our law.
Mm.
All our law is based on such beautiful principles. Notions of, you know, respect, responsibility, reciprocity, acceptance, connectedness, based all coming from, you know, deep hearted position of truth. You know, there's no negativity in that. Unfortunately, what Australia gets to see a lot of the time is what the media and government want Australia to see, and that's the negative coping of the pain and the suffering and the oppression. They don't even talk about what's led to the negative coping and the behaviours from that. They just show images of or write stories about people acting in negative ways. Because there's no ownership and responsibility built into Western society.
Mm. Yeah, what led to this? This just didn't just happen. Mm. It's been building like a powder keg for a long time. It's it was funny. I'd race world championships every year, and when we'd do it, you'd get like your Australian colours, and every year you'd get the green and gold and all that. And it wasn't until a couple years ago, I kind of thought, it's like, why has no one ever done Aboriginal art on their bike or in their clothing? Because to me, I was like, well, that's kind of true Australia. And it was one of those things that's like, it seems really obvious that that would be true Australia. And yeah, a couple of years ago when I was still competing, I just got a frame wrapped. I think it was Gundawindi.
Yeah, that's the top of my country.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was the tribe that, the mob that did it. I was going to actually ask you, I've got the frame still up here if you want to hang it.
Yeah, for sure. We'll
put in the sober building, and I've got like a jersey and stuff. But yeah, he did me up, he painted it all. And did it all for me, and it just like got a really good response. And I just, but it just, you know, after you do something, it seems very obvious. And I thought more people would do it, like leading on from that. And then last year I didn't compete, but just no one kind of carried it on. But then, which was really cool to see, the Australian cycling, they brought out their jerseys, and on the jerseys had Aboriginal art through all their race jerseys. And I feel pretty proud that I feel like I at least had some kind of kind of push in that direction to kind of showcase that art.
And that's right. And that's the thing, right? Like, we always have these moments where we can use our opportunities and resource to be a real positive influence. But too often people don't bother to do that. They don't bother to consider, what is it that I can do just in my everyday life with the everyday opportunities and resources that I've got available to me to help bring around some positive change. And it's not just for us as mob, as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. Like, as I said, like, this society we live in is fucked up. It needs to change. And we've got a whole bunch of information that can help guide a more positive change. But we need to feel more comfortable in being able to share that, knowing that it's going to be taken seriously and used in a positive way, rather than what we've unfortunately experienced in history, used against us in a negative way. But yeah, we've all got those opportunities, but there's just far too many people that either don't even bother considering it, or see it as too hard, and so can't do it, or feel like they're going to be judged by family, colleagues, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, people even asked me when I did the frame, a few people were like, oh, do you get any kickback or pushback to doing that? And I was like, no, why would I? Mm. Like, oh, it's like you're doing something different. I was just like, why? Like, that to me seems like more true Australia than the whole green and gold thing that we've been running for years.
Yeah, like, we've got such an opportunity as a country to actually have our own diverse cultural identity based on the oldest ongoing living cultures on the planet. Like, that's such an amazing opportunity for a nation to be able to nation build off. But we refuse to allow it in and to allow ourselves to learn as a society, you know, to listen to and learn from what that might look like.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're so obsessed with being America's little brother. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. You just copy the culture pretty much down to a T.
100%.
5 years behind, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Behind and more expensive. That's it. That's the only fucking difference.
Yeah. And our coffee's better.
Yeah. We've even overtaken them as being the most obese fucking country on the planet. Like,
have we?
Yeah.
Oh, it's sad. I was going to ask you, what is, I guess, the goals now moving forward with Sober and the direction you want to see it go?
Yeah, as a social enterprise, your opportunity to do good comes through your ability to grow. So I want to see Sober grow as big and bad as freaking possible. Like, I want us to be Australia's most recognised, most respected, most fucking sold craft non-alc beer company. But we want to go beyond that. We'll be moving into the space of other really cool and unique beverage offerings as well. And then we want to take over the world. Like, you know, I can do so much more as a social enterprise, not me personally, but we can do so much more with $1 million of committed funds towards the causes that we want to support than we can with zero or 5,000 or 10,000 per annum, you know. And that only comes through, you know, through sales. Like, for me, in my head, Sober's always been a wellness company, and wellness through connection company, and we just happen to make our revenue through selling non-alc beer. That's the direction I want to see it continue to go.
Yeah, I like that. Now, I've got three questions I always end the podcast with that I hit you with. long or short as answers, no matter what you want. But the first one is, what are you scared of?
My number one fear, and again, I only probably admitted this to my wife maybe 6 or 8 weeks ago. It's come on really strong. I don't know what, why. Maybe it's because of my age and I'm becoming aware of my mortality. Losing her, man. And not losing her in terms of us being divorced, but that'd be fine. Like, I could deal with that. Like, if knowing she was happy, if she's not with me, that'd be fine. But losing her as a human being on this planet scares the shit out of me. Yeah.
I was going to say, if you could go back to your younger self and give him some advice, what would it be?
Oh, fuck. Where do I start?
Well, I guess that's the role you started playing when you're helping others.
Be kinder to myself. Yeah. I've definitely at times been far too critical of myself. And not healthy criticism. Like, I've achieved some pretty fucking decent shit in my life and I've still been very judgmental of myself. Yeah. So just be kinder to myself, love myself more, and not in a weird fucking way. But I think, you know, I truly believe that we can only love others in a true way when we learn to love ourselves.
Mm. I had a lady on yesterday and she was talking about when this person did something really wrong by her and she forgave him, but she just, like, she still felt this way and she realized that she hadn't forgiven herself. Mm. And it wasn't until she forgave herself for even putting herself in that situation that she could actually let go. So it was like that powerful thing. It's like, okay, you can forgive the person, but if you don't forgive yourself for even putting yourself in that situation, that you're just going to keep carrying it with you.
Yeah.
So it's like you can forgive yourself for being so hard on yourself and just being like, oh, I kind of, that did happen for a reason.
Yeah.
You've dealt with it and then move forward.
Yeah, I think I've got better at it. I don't know if I've nailed it yet. I'm
still work pretty, in progress.
I'm still pretty damn hard on myself, but yeah.
It's a balancing act because I think it's good to be not so much hard on yourself, but keep yourself to a certain standard that you want to live by, but then not have that control your life and your decisions.
Yeah, I always want to be accountable.
Mm.
But I think I should stop being so judgmental of myself.
Yeah. How do you want to be remembered?
Oh, man, I honestly just want to be remembered for having done what I could with the opportunities and resources and the privileges that have been made available for me. Having done something positive with those for others.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. And last one, have you got a favourite quote and why?
Oh.
Something you might live by or...
Yeah.
Something that rings true to you.
Yeah, something that, you know, it's Professor Michael McDaniels. He's a pro vice chancellor at one of the universities down Sydney Way, Aboriginal lad. One of the things that's I found most empowering in the last, I guess, probably decade for me is a quote from him, and that's silence is a form of abuse. And as long as we continue the silence, we continue the abuse. So I guess that allowed me to not remain silent on things that I don't agree with.
Yeah, if you've got something on your mind, speak it.
Speak it and speak it from your position of truth, but also recognizing that your position of truth isn't the only one on this planet. And I think that's difficult for people. I think we often get caught up thinking that truth is this singular reality rather than truth is based on a position of what you've had the opportunity to learn and know and experience. And we've got 8 billion people on this planet who have all learned something, experienced something slightly different to each other. So we've got about 8 billion versions of truth here and now, a whole bunch before that and a whole bunch to come. It's pretty hard for people to wrap their heads around that at times.
Mm. Yeah, what's true to me might not be true to you. It just makes it different, doesn't make it wrong or right or true or false.
Absolutely. And I think the more accepting we can be of other people's positions of truth, the more opportunity we have to fucking just get along with each other.
Yeah, exactly. Stop trying to push back. And I think, yeah, it does take time to realize that. I think I realized that from a young age. I did a lot of traveling as a kid. And it was funny going back to small country town and you see all these people are so stuck in their ways about what's right and wrong.
Yeah.
And you just kind of go, it's just different.
Yeah.
Different's okay.
Yeah.
Different doesn't mean wrong.
And there's so much wonder and opportunity and beauty in diversity.
Mm.
Like, as long as we hold so steadfast to our own little singular position, we're just completely shutting ourselves off from the opportunity of getting to grow through that wonder of the diversity that exists around us.
Mm. Yeah, learn from it. Try and understand it. Don't shut off from it.
Yeah.
No. I really appreciated this.
No, it's been awesome, Jan.
Good,
thank you very
good
much.
Good chat. Thanks for coming on. No problem. I'll see you down at the brewery for a coffee.
For sure.
Thanks, Quinn.
Cheers, bro.
Cheers.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.